You're listening to Mom and Doc Talk, where we talk all things healing pans and pandas with an emphasis on homeopathy.
Hi, I'm Jody the Mom.
And I'm Dr. Bar the Doc, and welcome to Mom and Doc Talk. We are joined by another doc today who is going to share just a wealth of knowledge and expertise on a topic that we've had a lot of requests for, and this happens to also be a guest who was highly, highly requested. Offer a warm welcome in your cars, in your homes, wherever it is that you're listening to this, to Dr. Neil Nathan, who is here to talk with us and answer some of our questions from his upcoming book. I think it's actually released on the day that we're recording today, so it should be available by the time that this is out. But let me introduce you to you. For those of you who don't know, he doesn't really need much of an introduction in this community, but let me do it anyway. So Dr. Neil Nathan has been practicing medicine for over 50 years and has been board certified in family practice and pain management, and is a founding diplomat of the American Board of Integrative Holistic Medicine and a founding diplomat of ISEAI. He's written several books, including two that we're going to chat about today: Toxic, Heal Your Body from Mold Toxicity, Lyme Disease, Multiple Chemical Sensitivities, and Chronic Environmental Illness. And his newest release that I just mentioned that's out today, The Sensitive Patient's Healing Guide. Dr. Nathan has been treating complex chronic medical illnesses for 30 years now, and Lyme disease for the past 20 years. As his practice has evolved, he finds himself increasingly treating the patients who have become so sensitive and toxic that they can no longer tolerate their usual treatments, and has major current interest in finding unique ways of helping them to recover. Welcome, Dr. Nathan. We are so excited to have you because we focus on the same people, right? We have different approaches and some overlapping approaches for how we focus on the same people. But I'm so excited to have you here to join us today. So thank you.
Thanks for having me.
So you share in both of your books that you've had your own health challenges that really got you connected to the work that you do. I was hoping you might be willing to share a bit more about yourself and how you ended up here.
Hey, that could take up several podcasts. but let's see if we can get the Cliff Notes version in. So first of all, it wasn't my own health issues that got me interested in these things. They came later. I went to medical school wanting to be a healer, and I was very disappointed that that wasn't in the curriculum. So I went to the University of Chicago as a medical school. It was considered a very good school. And I realized that I was going to be taught to be a medical technician, not a healer. So I didn't lose my interest in doing that. I just realized I was going to have to learn a whole lot when I got out of medical school to help people the way I wanted to help them. So over the years, I've studied almost every branch you can think about: hypnosis, homeopathy, osteopathic manipulation, laying on of hands, emotional release techniques like Reiki and therapy, and on and on and on. All was in the service of helping me to help more people. It's kind of like, I didn't think of it then, but kind of like having a tool bag that was full of tools so that I could use the right tool for the right person. There was never one single tool that worked on everybody. It was, okay, what does this being need from me? And so that evolved over a long period of time. And over the years, I'm getting old. Bodies break down, and I did have a bunch of health challenges. Several years ago, I had a very severe case of colitis, in which it was both ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease, which is pretty rare. And the hard part was to find someone who had actually had a couple of cases of that, and they could guide me through that. But with conventional medicine, including taking a drug that I never would have wanted to take into other circumstances, which was Remicade, and a whole host of things that my other doctors didn't know about or wouldn't have approved of, I'm now in complete remission by, you know, colonoscopy biopsy confirmed. But I was really sick. I mean, I lost 35 pounds. I could barely walk from my lounge chair to the bathroom and back, which is I did all day long when I was really sick. So I've had a couple of health challenges. That helped me to appreciate how precious health is as a gift, which is, we often joke, you don't have anything if you don't have your health. And I think that's true. I mean, when I was confined to a chair for several months, barely just staying alive, that's not really living.
No.
And I think what I experienced when I came out of it was this intense joy of the gifts that I have been given and the opportunity to be in this phenomenal world that we inhabit. So, I mean, that's a short version of what you're asking about.
Yeah. I had the same thought when I was planning on going to medical school. It was just sheer chance that I happened upon naturopathic medicine. I didn't know that it was a thing. I understood that going to convention, like to allopathic conventional medical school, I would learn a certain part, but it wouldn't be like the what I was ultimately wanting to help people with. So I felt very fortunate that I accidentally stumbled on naturopathic medicine. So I can relate to some of your story.
Dr. Nathan, you start off your books by describing the difference between sensitivity and toxicity. I think that's a great foundation for us to lay in our conversation. So, can you explain what the difference between sensitivity and toxicity is and how you know which one you have or if it's truly both?
And sometimes it's both. Sensitivity is a function of the nervous system. We're really talking about the five senses, sight, sound, touch, smell, taste. This is our nervous system gives us that information. So sensitivity is anything that creates sensitivity of those senses. Like people who become sensitive to light, they have to wear sunglasses, not only outside, but sometimes inside. People who have sound sensitivity, where they'll startle if they hear a sound that other people wouldn't even react to. Chemical sensitivity is a big one, in which people get super sensitive to the smells of their environment and can actually become non-functional in seconds of exposure. EMF sensitivity is a newly emerging sensitivity, where people are becoming sensitive to their electromagnetic fields in their environment. Food sensitivity is a big one. Sensitivity to anything is all mitigated through the nervous system. Toxicity is that there's an actual toxin, a substance that is in your body that is affecting all of the cells in your body, depending on your own biochemistry and unique genetics, to make you sick. So, there is an overlap because many toxins affect the parts of the nervous system that control sensitivity. To be really specific, the limbic system and the vagal nerve system are the main parts of the nervous system that help create or make us sensitive, and many toxins will affect that. So, there's toxicity, and then there's sensitivity, and then there's both. I was looking at your questions today before we went on air. I just had this thought of expanding that discussion to how we relate to people, not just substances, but there are people that we are sensitive to, and that there are people for us that are actually toxic. Meaning it, and I think it's okay to expand that discussion to think about that as well, because a lot of people are very affected by the energies of the people that they're around. And we just see that a lot in my world, especially the people who've gotten sick tend to be more wired that way than others, so that they literally can feel the energies in the room when they go in and they become very sensitive to that. Now, that's one thing. But then there are people who are actually toxic to us, meaning when we're in their presence, they're either energy vampires and suck our energies out completely, or we leave their presence with a feeling of, I need to talk about this for days to get this out of my system. And it helps us to be able to identify those people so we can navigate the world a little better. Now, I realize I'm a little off topic, but I was, forgive me, tripping out on this connection this morning, which I had not really thought about before.
Well, no, that's totally fine. Actually, I'm going to go ahead and trip out with you. So we recently did an episode with a provider, and we were talking specifically about highly sensitive people. What's the difference between the sensitivity you were born with and the sensitivity you acquire? Or is it the same thing that's made more intense somehow?
Actually, a little bit of both. We are all wired at birth to have various gifts. So some people have a musical gift or an artistic gift, or you name it. We all have different propensities of things we're wired with to do. Now, those can be enhanced by studying, practice, working with a teacher or a mentor. And then there's the sensitivities that kind of get laid on us, so that a number of different medical conditions are inflammatory in nature. And it is basically inflammation that will make some of those things more dominant. So let's say you have a refined sense of smell, like you might, a cook, someone who rates restaurants, a wine connoisseur would have a much more refined palate or sense of smell than other people do. But that can be jacked up big time if they get mold toxicity or other medical conditions in which their limbic system goes into overdrive, and now their sense of smell is so carefully refined that they can barely be in certain environments. It's no longer voluntary. It's like it overwhelms them.
So I love that you just brought up the limbic system, because I want to, we were reading your books. We both recently read both Toxic and your newest book. We were trying to figure out, okay, how can we possibly cover all of the things? And we realized we don't need to cover all the things, right? We're going to cover the things that are most relevant to our community and that they've asked about a lot, so we can get some questions answered for them. And so one of those things that really came up for us was related to mast cell activation, and how that's really a challenge in the Pans Pandas community. Jody's got some experience with it in her family as well. And so I really wanted to dive in on this a little bit more. And in your new book specifically, both of them really that I've read, but both the new book really ties a lot of sensitivity and inflammation to the limbic system and the vagus nerve and mast cell activation all together. So I'd really love to dissect these here a little bit more, and to give our audience some context. So if we could start with the limbic system, that would be really great. So what is it, and what role does it play in sensitivity?
Great. So I appreciate your comments, and I want to augment them if possible, which is when we're talking about sensitivity, I really want to emphasize that I call it the trifecta of sensitivity, which is the limbic, vagal, and mast cell issues. And we can dissect them, and we'll talk about them today. But I really want your listening audience to know that they are totally interconnected. Mm-hmm. You can't talk about one without the other. You can't have one without the other, because the limbic, vagal, and mast cell components are all tied together. So we can talk about them separately, but I just want to be sure that we get the overview that they are interconnected. So mm-hmm. just as an example, many people will treat mast cells as if it's an isolated, separate thing.
Right.
And if they do so, they may get lucky, but the treatments they're doing may not work very well if they're not including a limbic and vagal piece to it, and vice versa. All systems have to work with the others. You've literally got to quiet them all down. The underlying theme of all of them is safety. Mm-hmm. That's what it's all about. So from that perspective, let's talk about the limbic system, which is its job neurologically is to keep you safe by scrutinizing the stimuli in the environment that you're exposed to. And if it doesn't think that you're in a safe environment, it's going to annoy you by giving you symptoms to wake you up and go, whoa, you don't want to be here. Let's get out of here. And those symptoms are not always pleasant. The limbic system's main neurological focus is on sensitivities and emotion. Mm-hmm. So how do you know that your limbic system is dysfunctional or not ideally working? Emotionally, if you have anxiety, depression, OCD, tics, mood swings, you name it, That's all limbic.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you may have had some of it earlier in your life, but if it has gotten worse noticeably, then something is triggering it. And we need to look for that something because it's treatable. Now, on the sensitivity side, sensitivity to anything and everything is limbic. So talking about sensitivity to light, sound, touch, food, chemicals, smells, EMFs, limbic. So any patient who has either or both an emotional or sensitivity issue, by definition, has a limbic issue. That's not possible to not have that. So that's basically what the limbic system is, and that's what it does.
You talk in your book a little bit, and correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm making sure I understand, that it's not necessarily that the limbic system is dysfunctional from, it's that it's responded to something that's problematic, and then it becomes highly sensitive to the concerning issue. Is that accurate?
Really. Almost.
Okay.
Almost. Your limbic system, which is out there to protect you, that's its job. It's not trying to hurt you, it's just trying to protect you. In fact, all three systems, that's its job. Keep you safe by protecting you.
Mm-hmm.
The limbic system is formed throughout our life, from the time we're in our mother's uterus to the time that we're a child and as we grow. The limbic system is constantly evaluating the environment for safety. So none of us have had perfect childhoods. If we had recurrent ear infections and throat infections, took a lot of antibiotics, if we required surgery, if we had distant parents, or if we had parents who were abusive, either emotionally, physically, sexually, any of those things makes our limbic system go, whoa, not safe. Mm-hmm. I need to wire up to really pay attention to this environment so that I can navigate this and get safe. And then as we get older and we go through puberty, we have relationships and we have abandonment issues, and we're hurt by other people and they don't treat us well. So this limbic system that we're living with is the sum total of all of those events leading up to where we are right now. So our limbic system has becoming slowly and steadily wired for protection and safety throughout our life. Let's take COVID, for example, which was a major sensitizer. COVID affected this planet profoundly in terms of, it's not safe out there.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to wear masks and we're going to stay 6 feet apart and we're going to isolate. And you don't know who out there will give you this horrible virus that might kill you. So we still have the virus in our life. It's not as dangerous as it was, but we have all been, if you will, scarred or affected by what we went through. And this adds another dimension to this whole wiring process for safety that the limbic system goes through. So here we are coming up to the present day. Now, if you get something that is infecting you or toxic to you, call it the strep bacteria, Lyme disease, mold toxicity, any number of other viruses, other infections, that's the straw that breaks the camel's back.
Mm-hmm.
That's the one that goes, okay, I've kind of been coping with the world that I know of, and now the limbic system's overwhelmed. And that same process is also true for the vagal system, which we'll talk about. It's also true for mast cells. So it's a cumulative process. And I think that's a super important message to get across to your listeners, because it didn't just happen today because you got mold toxicity. It's
right.
It's been building in your system for a long time, and curing it. And my take-home message is going to be, everything we're talking about today is curable. Everything mm-hmm. is treatable. But it often involves more, I'll call it homework, that homework that mm-hmm. we have to do on ourselves to undo the effects that have been done to our nervous system throughout time. And we can mm-hmm. do that. But a lot of people go, oh, well, that's a lot of work. I had a lot of stresses in my life. That's true. But if you don't do something to reboot your limbic system or your vagal system or your mast cells, you're going to be at the mercy of the universe that will throw more stuff at you, which it's going to do. Yeah. It's not being mean.
And we're definitely going to get to a couple of the things that you recommend in your book to help with resetting that. And I know that you have studied homeopathy and you've got a lot of respect for homeopathy. And it's, we talk about things in the same way from the homeopathic perspective, right? With that, that it's not, it's not the strep, it's the susceptibility to having this response to strep. It's not the mold, it's the way, I mean, the mold is part of it, you know, the strep is part of it, but it's also the way that you're responding to it. And we have to address that underlying susceptibility to have this atypical response in order to fully heal, as well as addressing some of the issues that are coming up as well. So before we jump into that, because I want to make sure we understand, since it's three pieces sort of all interconnected and overlapping, I'd like to shift gears and talk a little bit more about the vagus nerve and the role that it plays. So you talk a lot about polyvagal theory in both of your books. So can you tell us a little bit more about what polyvagal theory is and the role that the vagus nerve plays in sensitivity?
I really wish Stephen Porges hadn't called it polyvagal theory, because that makes it sound like it's theoretical and it's not. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That was what he called it in 1994 when he, who is a researcher in the field, realized that we weren't appreciating the importance of the vagus nerve in our health. Mm-hmm. And so I call it vagal dysfunction rather than polyvagal theory, just because I don't want people to think we haven't really nailed this down as being important. We have. So the vagus nerve is a cranial nerve that is the longest in the body. It comes down from our brain and goes into our neck, our lungs, our heart, the entire intestinal tract is innervated by the vagus nerve. So it's kind of important. And in addition to that, it's a major component of what we call the autonomic nervous system, which is the part of our body that takes care of autonomic functions like breathing, temperature control, appetite, and things of that nature. So if you want to think about, well, what symptoms would tell you that the vagus nerve is being, is not working properly, the, first of all, anything that affects intestinal functioning, gas, bloating, distension, reflux, constipation, diarrhea, that's all a vagally mediated thing. Sometimes palpitations and chest discomfort and shortness of breath and air hunger can be that as well. But on the autonomic side, the, for example, getting POTS, which many of our patients do, having blood pressure irregularities that fluctuate and move up and down, temperature dysregulation, where I'm too hot, I'm too cold, my body's just not getting into a palpitations where the heart begins to beat unusually quickly. All of that tells us, well, the vagus nerve is dysregulated also. That's how we know that that's affected.
And how about, how can a parent tell if they're more likely to have a limbic problem or a vagus nerve concern, or maybe both?
Almost always it's both, because both of them are the parts of the brain that's job is to monitor our environment for safety, and they work together on it. It's a little bit like a tag team. So it's almost impossible to have limbic dysfunction and not have vagal dysfunction, and vice versa, because both of those systems are out there evaluating our world, and mm-hmm. it's unlikely that one is going to think the world is safe and the other one's going to think it's really dangerous. It's just, I mean, there's really concordance in the brain yeah. about what it thinks it's looking at. So you're almost always going to have both. And again, in clinically working with folks, I find that some people so get focused on limbic work that they don't do any mast cell or vagal work, and it doesn't work as well as you need it to be, because it has to be both.
Yeah. In your book, Toxic, you share that you have found that about 50% of highly sensitive or reactive patients have mast cell activation issues. Can you explain what this is and how it affects these patients?
Sure. And I'd actually say it's closer to 70%+. But
oh, wow.
That's, I I normally say that if I said 50% in the book, I'm underestimated.
Well, it's your older book, so maybe things have updated since then.
Okay. I think in my older book, mast cell activation had just come into our knowledge sphere. And my only comment then was, I'm seeing a lot of mast cell activation in my sensitive and sick patients. But now, over time, it's been 6 years since Toxic was first written.
Yeah.
It's even more a big deal. It's gone from being a quirky little thing that people thought might be interesting to, whoa, this mm-hmm. is a big deal here. Back then, we didn't have the statistics we have now to show that 17% of the population is prone to mast cell activation. Back then, it was in the category of, it's a kind of a rare genetic thing. We're seeing more of it than we used to. But now that we've been studying it, it's been studied hard. It's mm-hmm. no. This is a big deal and it affects a whole lot of people.
So as I understand it, and I think that maybe in our conversation, I'm realizing maybe I understood it a little bit incorrectly. I was understanding from reading your books that the limbic system and vagus nerve are the underlying cause of mast cell disease. So like, is that not accurate that they're actually all interconnected, or are they actually part of what triggers mast cell activation for people?
I don't think I'd use the word cause,
okay,
but I would use the word predisposed. So when the limbic and vagal systems are not functioning properly and thinking that there is threat, over time, the mast cell system will come along to the same conclusion. Now, the limbic and vagal is a neurological process. So I want everyone to understand that this is not a psychological process, it's neurological. And a lot of the patients who experience these things are wrongly accused of, oh, this is in your head. No, it's not. The mast cell system is a cellular safety protection defense system that comes into play when the connection between the immune system and the nervous system gets to the point that it fires up.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure I would say it's causative, but it sets the table for the mast cells to become activated when they are facing some sort of a more specific trigger. So if I was going to use the word cause, and maybe this is a language thing, I would use the number one cause of mast cell activation is mold toxicity. Lyme disease is close behind. EMFs are another cause of it. And then some viruses, other bacteria, can also be triggers, but by far, in my experience, mold toxicity and Lyme disease are the major triggers for mast cell activation.
Yeah.
But once triggered, because of the very complicated interweaving between the nervous system and the immune system, and mast cells are the bridge between those two systems. That's what balances out. When the nervous system is freaking out, that bridge becomes unsteady. So
yeah,
maybe I'm splitting hairs to not use the word cause, but I would say predisposed.
Yeah, I think it's an important thing, right? Because so many people are looking for like the underlying cause of things. And you know, when we talk about it from a homeopathy perspective, we talk about, again, the underlying cause of things is a susceptibility to this. And like, even in your books, you share that 75% of the population, this was from Toxic, I think, believe more than your newer book, that 75% of the population can handle mold and can form appropriate antibodies, detox from it, and not have it be a problem. So it's really like the vast majority of people are not as susceptible to mold, whereas the people who have the susceptibility are more likely to react to it. And then even when we get into so like I always talk about like mold, Lyme, et cetera, that they're the trigger, like you were talking about before, the trigger that like is the straw that broke the camel's back or whatever, like piles up and piles up from all the things of the limbic system, the vagus nerve and just triggers and the susceptibility overall. But that that ultimately we have to look at the fact that you're just sensitive to having an atypical response to these things. And that because everybody has a different type of response, like, you know, Jody has had some mold issues in her family and she's had PANS and MCAS as her primary presentations for that. My husband struggles with mold issues and he has more of like a physical manifestation and like skin stuff, not so much respiratory stuff. I seem to be one of those, I'm probably one of those 75%. I don't even notice it if I'm in a moldy space. So I must be lucky with my ability to handle things. So I just wanted to, I mean, but I think that like the splitting hairs over the language, I think that does matter, especially for the people who are struggling because they really want to find an answer. So I appreciate the conversation.
Well, I when I use the word cause, it's in a very, very important word. You're right. Mm-hmm. I want people to know or what I know, and what I know is still a work in progress. We're still learning as we go. So I just know what I know currently, and I have been known to publicly change my mind about different things, and I'm perfectly okay with that. Mm-hmm. As we learn, I learn and go, okay, I thought it was that way, but I guess it's, maybe it's this way.
Mm-hmm.
I want to maybe weave together something. We didn't use the word in our earlier conversation, but what we were all referring to are people who are empaths, people who are empathic to the point that they can literally feel what other people are going through. And I get the question sometimes, and people who are asking good questions, but empaths are more vulnerable to all of these things mm-hmm. because they are more sensitive. Their body is wired to take in things from the universe and not as good about protecting themselves from the things they're taking in. It's just how they're wired. And I think about it as having a gift and a liability. Mm-hmm. The gift of empathy is that you can connect to people at a very deep level. You can really feel what they're feeling. They can feel that you can feel what they're feeling. You can connect that way and really resonate with them. I think that's great. Mm-hmm. The liability is many people who are empathic can't always separate what they are feeling from what they're feeling coming in from the outside world. And then there's a tendency for empaths to take in other people's feelings that aren't theirs and be affected by it. Mm-hmm. And so that's the tricky balance in that.
Yeah.
And so empaths are at higher risk of getting these various conditions because both toxins and microbes find them to be a nice home.
That's kind of what I think Jody was getting at with our, with bringing up the highly sensitive person, which I think, you know, is maybe another word for empath or, you know, cause I don't know, but a lot of people use the word empath and think of just like emotions and like a highly sensitive person is just more sensitive in general. Right. So I appreciate though, that you bring that together because some people might not recognize that that there's like an overlap with somebody who is an empath and just a highly sensitive person, how we're wired and differently. So I appreciate you bringing that together.
I feel like I'm going to take us into left field for just a minute, but I do feel like I need to take a moment to have an appreciative pause for this entire conversation, because you're talking about it from the doctor's perspective. And I experienced so much of what you're talking about from the patient or mom of the patient perspective. My younger daughter was born in 2010 and was in utero living in mold and born into that mold. So she was born extremely, extremely sensitive, literally reactive to everything. No safe food, couldn't leave the house, nothing. And so our worlds were just absolutely insane. And I experienced that thing where you're talking about where it was an of my mind thing, where providers would not talk to me or, you know, nobody knew anything about mast cell disease. There were a couple, but these conversations that are happening to me are like, I get so excited about it because these were all things that I went through when there wasn't much education. But I especially appreciate this conversation because when my daughter was 2 years old, I was literally throwing the kitchen sink at her because she was still 2 years old, didn't have safe food, didn't, wasn't able to leave our house because she was having such severe mast cell reactions and going into the hospital all the time because of respiratory issues. I was just throwing everything at her. I took her to a traditional Chinese medicine doctor, and this was before I was ready to open my mind up to all of these things. And I remember that provider talking to me about the limbic system and the vagal nerve. And at the time I was like, this guy is nuts. Like, this is the craziest stuff I've ever heard. He had me sitting in a chair with her, spinning around, doing exercises. And I remember going home and telling my husband, this guy was a wackadoodle. Like, this is crazy. So I really appreciate all of these conversations that you are willing to have, the books, all of that stuff, to give us more kind of knowledge and education. And, you know, our family got really fortunate as far as, you know, with my daughter, homeopathy has pretty much gotten rid of a good majority of her mast cell reactions. She still has a tiny bit of stuff that we're working through. But all of these conversations where you're bringing all of this information in and helping us make sense of all of it, I know our community is super appreciative. I'm appreciative because I still don't understand the kind of the limbic vagal connection with all of it. So just had to take a pause to mention that we all appreciate you very much for having this conversation with us.
Thank you. That's why I wrote this book. I've been working with sensitive people for a long time and taking it seriously and knowing I didn't have the knowledge or tools to help them the way I wanted to help them. And in the last 20 years, we've learned a tremendous amount about what makes a person sensitive and then how to fix it. So that's why I wrote, you know, the Sensitive Patient's Healing Guide. And I have in it 20 guest authors who are top in the field for having worked with this. So it wasn't like, I didn't want this book to be my opinion. I wanted it to be a consensus book of experts who work at this from a variety of different angles, so that the people who read it would go, people have been telling me this has been in my head for years. It's not. Mm-hmm. This is in my body and my tissues, and they're telling me we can treat it now, which we can't. Mm-hmm. So that's why I wrote it. My hope was to stop the marginalization of all the people that have been labeled, as you probably had somewhere along the line, and to have them understand, we now know enough that we can help y'all.
All right, let's dive in a little bit more on some of these things that you recommend to help with calming the nervous system, calming the limbic system and the vagus nerve. So in both Sensitive Patient's Healing Guide and Toxic, you talk about dynamic neural retraining system, and you really credit it with getting things moving for people who are like just sort of stuck. So can you, and this has actually been asked about in our community several times, so can you tell us a little bit more about what DNRS is and why it's so helpful in these cases?
I can, and I would want to talk about, in the same breath, amygdala retraining, mm-hmm. which Ashok Gupta put together, and a newer program, which I like a lot, by Kathleen King, called Primal Trust. Those are my three favorites, and there are others. All of them have, as its essence, a rebooting process for the limbic system. On the surface, it might look sometimes like meditation, and I'm a big fan of meditation, but it's much more specific for the limbic system than just meditation. Now, Annie Hopper's program is a little different in that she has a series of words, phrases, gestures, and movements that she asks people to go through to do this rebooting process. Part of it is about consciousness. The vast majority of people who have these issues are pretty negative, and they are not aware that the negative thoughts that they have are keeping the limbic wiring messed up. To rewire the limbic system, you have to replace the negativity with positivity. You can almost tell someone who's limbically impaired by you suggest to them they do something, they'll go, you watch their face, and they Oh, I don't think I can do that. I've tried so many things and that didn't work. I don't think I'm willing to do that. I'm literally looking at the limbic system talking to me and telling me I'm scared about doing it. Now, you've never done this before. You have no idea whether it's going to work or not, but you're already predisposed through the negativity that it's not going to work because of your fear. Meaning the fear has gone through your whole tissues to the point that I'm not willing to take risks. I feel terrible, but I'm not sure I want to do anything to get better because that might make me worse. I've tried some things before and it hasn't worked. So Annie's is a more verbal and movement-oriented way of doing it. Now, the most difficult thing is with children. Not all children can do that, certainly not at very young ages. So the youngest child that I've been able to do Annie's program has been 7. And that was when they did it with their parent, so that the parent would walk them through it and the child would do it with it. It becomes a little bit of a game. And I've seen it work. As kids get older, as they get 10, by 12, 13, 14, kids can do it. Now, not all 14-year-old kids will do it. Some people, they'll do what Jody described as, this is stupid. Why would I want to say these words over and over again? And why would I do it? Come on, that's just stupid. I'm not doing that. So working with teenagers is always interesting, but some will embrace it and some will just give you a hard time. What I often ask kids to do is give me 6 weeks. Do this 10 minutes a day for 6 weeks, and then you tell me if it's stupid. And if it is, I'll get off your back. And if you are shockingly finding you're better, how about we keep going with it? So the hardest thing about the rebooting processes is that almost all of them are not designed for really younger kids, kids who are going through that who need a limbic reboot, but they're just not cognitively advanced enough to be able to do it. Now, the same thing is true with the Asha Gupta program, which is a bit more meditative in nature. He calls them meditations. They're not really meditations. They're really guided visualizations, but it comes at it a bit differently. So there are certain people who really resonate to what Annie's doing. I've had over 1,000 people do her program with benefit, and I've had over 1,000 people do Asha Gupta's program. And the newer one, the Primal Trust that Kathleen King has put together, kind of combines parts of both and adds some newer information as we're learning it. But for anyone who is a teenager or above, certainly adults, all work. But they just have to be done a little bit. Often the people who do these programs will ask that you do it for an hour a day. That's way too much for most people. 10, 15 minutes a day is all you need. And that's the limbic piece of treatment. If I shift to the vagal piece, those are treated really differently. So, vagal treatments, again, the ones that I like the best include one, there are some new devices which are called vagal nerve stimulators. That, if a child is not unduly sensitive to vibration, that's something that they can do. One of the most gentle of them is called Apollo Neuro. It's like a band that you can wear on your wrist, and you can program it with an app for your phone for programs that they call calm and unwind. But again, you don't want to do it the way the instructions in the box tell you, like wear it 5 to 8 hours a day. Absolutely not. Wear it for a couple of minutes once a day, and then slowly nudge that up to maybe 10 minutes once or twice a day.
That's because these are really highly sensitive people, right? So they're going to be more reactive to like any stimulus, even if it's a healing stimulus.
Very absolutely true. Another thing I like, especially for kids, is osteopathic cranial work. Very gentle and very well received. Most kids love it. And it's a very subtle but powerful way to reboot the nervous system and to deal with any structural issues which people may have developed along the way, which can influence the body as well. Another thing I like for kids is a neurofeedback technique called the lens, which uses brain mapping as a process. And you can use that on very young kids. I've used it on autistic kids and patients with traumatic brain injury. You don't have to do anything. You just attach little clips to the ears. It reads brain waves in 21 different areas of the brain, and then it reboots that with a homeopathic electrical signal put into areas of the brain that are electrically underperfused. So, I mean, these are, and then there's more, but these are some of the methods that we use to reboot the vagus system. And for kids, those are more accessible than the limbic methods that we talk about. One system that bridges both of them is called frequency-specific microcurrent, which is a very, very light electrical stimulation that has a vagal piece to it, so that, and it has a limbic piece to it. It's the only one that covers both, so that you can get a program that will rebalance those systems. And they have a separate program for mast cell activation, by the way, which is also helpful. So these are a few of some of the more effective ways that we've seen to reboot the vagal system.
I'm curious if you have any experience with anybody using the GammaCore. Have you found that to be really helpful?
GammaCore is the best researched of these devices, but I find it too strong for my sensitive people often. Okay. That in theory, it would work even better because you're stimulating directly over the vagus nerve. And I have some people who use it with benefit, but for my sensitive folks, I mean, I was really gung-ho when I first heard about it from the fellow who developed it, but it's a bit strong. You got to be really careful with sensitive folks.
Yeah, I've actually, so I used it. I struggle with migraines, and I was, unfortunately, I'm one of apparently a small number of people that the GammaCore failed for. It didn't end up helping me, but it is strong. I mean, like, just so you guys know, if anybody's considering using it, like, you, it's strong enough that you apply it right here, and you have to make it so that you're contracting, and like your face is going down for anybody's watching the video. So it's like it forces a frown onto you, basically, for it to be effective. So one of our jobs is to sort of mind read the people who are going to be listening to this in our community. And I feel like I'm mind reading some of the skeptical folks in the community, of which I happen to be one. I tend to be like a more skeptical person. Like, it's shocking to me that I practice homeopathy, because I was and still to this day I'm somewhat skeptical of it. I'm less so now than I was even a couple of years ago. But so I'm remembering an example from your book that was one of your co-authors had shared, from a person who had gone through one of the retraining programs and was putting together an air conditioner. I don't know if you remember this example, like the air conditioner that they were concerned about there being a plastic smell that would come from heating up the plastic coils. And when they they turned it on, switched it on, sure enough, they started to smell something, and they started to have the physical response that they typically have from, chemical exposure. And then they realized that it wasn't actually coming from that it was coming from a pot that they'd been boiling water in, that the water had boiled off. And so they were smelling from the pot. And as soon as they realized it wasn't from the air conditioner, that the symptoms went away. And so I can imagine a lot of people who are on the skeptical side reading that and saying, oh, so this is basically just saying that you just, it was all in your brain to begin with. How would you respond to somebody who says it's all in your brain?
That's true. And that's a beautiful example of how the limbic system becomes hypervigilant and overprotective. So it starts to smell something questionable, and it goes into, uh-oh, not a good thing. This is dangerous. Now, then the brain tries to make sense out of it. Now, that's all well and good, because it may make the correct conclusions and it may make wrong conclusions. But it doesn't change the fact that the limbic system was trying to tell that person that there was something in the environment that was dangerous. You needed to become aware of it and do something about it. It's still limbic, and it's still protective. It doesn't change it at all. People can be skeptical or not skeptical. what I could share from my own experience, have treated literally thousands of people who are really sensitive at this point. These methods have revolutionized our ability to help people get well who are really non-functional, skeptical. I'll give you a story. I had a patient with mold toxicity who was the head lawyer of a 200 lawyer firm in New Orleans. And he called me up. He wanted my help in treating. He had found out he had mold toxicity, and his symptoms were very limbic in origin. And what I said, what I wanted you to do first is Annie Hopper's DNRS program. So he called me up a few days later after he got the program. Now, at first glance, Annie's program looks a little bit simplistic and sophomoric. She asked people to say certain words and certain phrases and say them over and over again. And he calls me up and he goes, "Now y'all know what this program sounds like, right? You're asking me to say these words and these phrases over and over again, and that's going to make me get better. Is that what you're telling me?" I said, "Yep." He said, "I said, tell you what, you do this for 6 weeks, and then you can call me up and chew me out if it's not working." So he called me back in about 6 weeks, and he says, "You got any other harebrained things that work? Because I am 90% better now, having done this stuff. I'll do anything you ask now, because I know that there's something to it." So it was just a good example of super skeptical, but he felt so bad, which is where our patients are. I'll do anything, even say these stupid words and phrases over and over again. And Annie's words and phrases are carefully constructed from neuro-linguistic programming that improve the ability of the neurons for neuroplasticity. I mean, that's so they may sound a little bit simplistic, but they work. So again, you can be as skeptical as you want, but if you feel terrible, these are pretty simple things that we're asking you to do that have healed a whole lot of folks.
And when it's similar to stuff with homeopathy, which, I mean, homeopathy has a little bit more like risk of aggravation and like potential like short-term worsening of symptoms. But when we're talking about people who need potentially to use this type of treatment, they're people who generally are so sensitive to other things that like, what are their other options? Right. So.
But I'll point out that some of my patients are super sensitive to homeopathics.
Yes.
Even in the tiniest doses. So we have to be looking at the folks we're working with from their perspective and not assume that, well, this is really simple. I'm asking you to take one drop of a homeopathic remedy, right? What could that do? Well, it can throw someone under the bus if it's, it might even be the right remedy, but too strong and that person's not ready for it. So again, until the limbic and vagal systems begin to feel safer, many of our sensitive patients aren't going anywhere.
Yep.
And it's all about safety. Now, I don't know if that one drop of homeopathic is truly toxic for that person, but their limbic system thinks it is or is worried that it is. And it's just going to shut that person down because I don't think that's safe.
Yeah.
And that's, I mean, the tricky thing about all of it. But take home message, everything we're still talking about is treatable.
Yeah. Absolutely. If we have just a few more minutes of your time, there's one other concept that I would like to just touch on really briefly, because I do think it's important to bring to people's attention, and that's porphyria, that you talk about that can overlap with symptoms of mold, Lyme, MCAS, PANS. And from what I understand from how you've talked about it too, that it can even be sometimes triggered by having those symptoms. So can you tell us a little bit more about what it is and how someone might differentiate if they're experiencing porphyria or if they're having porphyria in addition to these things or triggered by those things?
Yeah, that's opening up a whole can of worms here. But since you want to open the can, we will. So there's two kinds of porphyria. There's an exceptionally rare genetic group of porphyrias, and it's so rare that in my 50 years of medical practice. I've never seen a case.
Right.
Okay. Then there are what we call secondary porphyrias, where perturbations to the body in various ways will trigger the body's inability to break down hemoglobin properly. And you might say, well, who cares about that? Well, every one of us breaks down hemoglobin every 90 to 120 days because we recycle our red blood cells. So it's something that's kind of important to our metabolism.
Yeah.
And if that biochemistry gets messed up, then porphyrins will build up in our body and cause us a significant amount of grief. The most obvious symptoms of what we call a secondary porphyria are the rather sudden onset of what looks like a herx to someone who's worked in the Lyme world, where all of a sudden you're doing okay, and then you are overwhelmingly anxious and panicky and have extreme nausea to the point that you can't stop throwing up. Now, often these porphyric episodes are triggered by taking an antibiotic of some sort, like we might use for Lyme disease or chlamydia or Bartonella or you name it. So we put it in our head, okay, took the antibiotic, now feeling awful. It's got to be a herx, which is a reaction to the toxins released by killing these bacteria. But these folks don't get better in 2 or 3 days.
Right.
A normal herx will be gone in 2 or 3 days. But these reactions go on for days and weeks, and they just can't get anything other than colossally anxious, throwing up, nausea. Just so when that happens, think of the possibility of a secondary porphyria. And if that's the case, it's an easy thing to measure. It's just a spot urine. You just collect urine. You cover that, whatever you collect it in, cover it in aluminum foil. Keep it in the refrigerator until you can get it to the laboratory. And then LabCorp and Quest have a what they call a porphyrin panel. Mm-hmm. And if those are elevated, it means that is happening. And the treatment for it, and there is treatment for it, is very different than what we normally do for the mm-hmm. usual things of mold and Lyme and other conditions. Because for all of those, we want to minimize carbohydrate intake. For mm-hmm. porphyria, we want to maximize it. And in fact, the quickest way to break an attack is to give someone an intravenous infusion of 10% glucose. That takes the strain on the liver out immediately, and this whole system can settle down. So there are a surprising number of people who have a secondary porphyria. Measuring it, very helpful, because it tells us when you have these episodes, your diet has to be different. You need to eat more carbs, mm-hmm. and we need to treat you differently until it settles down. And then we can go back to what we were doing.
Yeah. I wanted to bring this up just because we see a lot of people report that they have prolonged reactions to antibiotics. And so I am curious if you would say that in the people who fall into the highly sensitive category, that they should still only expect a few days of Herxheimer reaction, or if they might tend to have a more prolonged reaction just because of their sensitivity.
No, a herx is a herx. Sensitive okay. people have the same kind of a herx that other people do.
Okay. So if somebody is having, even if they're a highly sensitive person and or a heightened sensitivity from acquired reasons, and they have a prolonged negative reaction to antibiotics, then they should maybe suspect porphyria and look into see if that's contributing.
Maybe, but you can also have a side effect of a antibiotic usage. You can have an allergic reaction.
Right.
So it has to be
different.
It just has to be teased apart. I never said this was anything other than complicated,
right.
because it is. I do want to make one overriding comment for mm-hmm. your listeners who are struggling with PANS and PANDAS and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
What I wanted to comment was a huge percent of those are being triggered by Lyme and mold.
Yep.
I mean, when PANS and PANDAS got started, it was all about strep. And now we know that was just a tip of the iceberg. It's a whole yes. lot more complicated than that. So I just want to be sure that getting tested for mold and Lyme should be a part of what all of these kids get tested for, because it's treatable, those two things are the single most common major, I'll use the word causes here, of everything that occurs and everything that happens downstream. So I just hope that that's happening, because I know it's not.
It's happening more. It's happening more and more these days. You know, like we see it in the community that we serve. And there's a lot more awareness that mold, especially if you're seeing progress happen and then it stops or it stalls out, there's probably mold that has been an exposure or consistent exposure that needs to be addressed. And that's one reason. So we've talked to your partner in crime, Dr. Jill Krista. She's been on with us before. We've had Michael Schrantz has come on twice to talk about mold remediation, just because we recognize the importance of addressing mold and recognizing it, catching it. Even Samuel Hahnemann talked about it, and not directly, he didn't necessarily say mold, but he talked about living in damp dwellings, that and that's an obstacle to healing. And so it is something that we talk about regularly. And I always have to go back again, once again, to that susceptibility and recognizing that even if we know that the mold is a problem, we can help the totality by looking at the way that we respond to mold, the specific susceptibility that we have. And that's where homeopathy really plays a big role in helping to stimulate healing, so you can be more resilient in the face of those exposures that you're going to have in the future, because we can't live in a completely mold-free world or a completely toxin-free world. So it's about helping our bodies become less feeling like they're in danger when they're exposed to it, and then more resilient to the actual physical response that they're having. So, well, Dr. Nathan, I appreciate your time and your expertise so much today. I loved your books, and I've loved every time I've gotten a chance to hear you lecture. You've made a huge impact in the integrative community. I'll tell you that I was just recently at a conference here in California, and you were brought up by at least two of the presenters. So your work is really got spider webs going out to lots of different places. So I appreciate that you were willing to come and chat with us and talk to your audience, or to our audience, about this particular small aspect of everything that you share. I'm going to tell everybody, we'll put links in the show notes for how to get all of your books, because as I said, we could have scheduled like five different podcasts and just barely been scratching the surface of all the information that you have in especially your newest book. I know that you're not practicing and like seeing patients directly anymore, but you've got a lot of impact on providers. So is there a way that people could get in touch with you if they're wanting to either like send their provider to learn more from you, or to just learn more from you in general?
Well, both, but I mean, I do a lot of consultations with, they're all designed to teach as much as they are to help. So they're all with the patient and their healthcare provider and me on a Zoom call.
Oh, fantastic.
In which we go over their whole health issues and lab work in detail. And I try to provide what I think is a blueprint for how to get well, or point out what aren't we dealing with? What did we miss? What does this person need to do? What is the pace that they need to go at? I do a lot of that. And you can access that through my website, which is simply neilnathanmd.com.
Perfect.
And then I have a mentorship program with Jill, my partner in crime, huh? one of my more brilliant ideas over the years was to make the mentorship program to include the whole naturopathic approach, along with, I'll call it the allopathic approach, although nobody who knows me thinks I'm an allopath, but that's another story. And so we teach over 100 healthcare providers about what we've learned and how to think about and manage Lyme, mold, environmental toxicity, the entire gamut that a lot of our patients are struggling with.
All right, and we'll make sure we put links to all of that stuff so people can find it easily in our show notes. Thank you again for your time today.
My pleasure. Hope this is helpful for y'all.
Yes, it has been.
Take care, everybody.
Okay.
We hope you found this episode helpful, hopeful, and inspiring. We try to get a new episode out every week. You can make sure you don't miss any by following us on Spotify or subscribing to our channel on YouTube. If you want to connect with us more, join our Facebook group, Homeopathy for Pans and Pandas, where we have exclusive weekly videos and answer your questions about, you guessed it, homeopathy for pans and pandas throughout the week. If you are already a member, give us a shout out and let us know what you thought about this episode. If you aren't on Facebook and would like to reach us, you can email us at podcast@resiliencenaturopathic.com. Until next time, take care and remember, this won't be forever.